Okay, thank you for coming. It is my pleasure to introduce you back to the 2021-2022 session of Pace Talks. We usually start in September, but this year we are starting in October. So we apologize about that, but great to see everybody here. I'll share the poll with you because there are almost one-third of you who are new to Pace. Around about 70% of people have been here before, but 30% to 35% are new. In terms of Pace is about something that people volunteer in. All the Pace speakers, like today that Bill will introduce, volunteer their time. There's no sponsorship or remuneration provided to any of the speakers, any of the volunteers, and anybody who participates in it. Topics are suggested by the audience, and that is why the question two on your thing. The Pace group meets once a year, says, okay, what do we want to hear about? We put a list, and then we crowdsource, and we'll see what you think about. Topics reflect the spirit of integrative medicine rather than just traditional medicine or one specialty or the other. The speakers usually speak for 20 to 25 minutes. Today we have two speakers, so that might be a little bit longer. And then we leave at least one-third of the time for Q&As, and feel free to ask any questions to the speaker. And then we also have a 5 to 10 minute general questions about integrative healthcare. This is what Pace is. What it is not is really, it is not about funding or government or hospital policy. The speakers are not providing treatment advice. These sessions are conversation starters, and there is no solicitation or marketing of services through this. So it's a very pure, sheer discussion in the community. So in terms of topics for the future, we'll take a snapshot of this, but it looks like the most popular one that you want to hear about is sleep. And the next is how to get back on track for wellness and preventive care that has been sidelined during the pandemic. Very pertinent. And the third is how to age gracefully. So we can pretty much, this is, I would say, I'm a bit surprised. I didn't think that getting back to preventive care would be such of interest, but that is where the power of the panel comes in. So I will turn over the conversation now to today's moderator, but I would like to introduce Bill Pravecki. Bill is a very staunch believer in the community part of the true spirit of community. He helps people, he contributes with his thoughts, he contributes with his action. He has been a Pace speaker before and spoke very elegantly. The reason we picked him for being the moderator today, because we wanted the patient to drive the conversation rather than the doctors to drive the conversation about the doctor-patient interaction. So over to you, Bill. And again, thank you for taking the time. And I tell you, Bill takes this seriously. So I will step out, and I don't have Dr. Ali on the spotlight. Is he spotlighted or no?
He's not spotlighted. It's not giving me the option to spotlight Dr. Bergava.
Okay, I will work on that, but why don't Bill, I turn it over to you.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction, Dr. Bergava. I'm honored to be your panelist, or not panelist rather, but your moderator and host tonight. Jen, if we can flip over to the first screen, please. So tonight we have the privilege of having two great local doctors, Dr. Jackie Gardner-Nix and Dr. Kays Al-Ali, who will kind of share with us the topic, and the topic being the physician-patient interaction, the changing landscape for better care. So as we all know, things have changed in the last decade, even in the last few years, but I'm looking forward to them sharing with us how they've seen the change take place. Jen, can you flip over to the next screen, please? So the things that come to people's minds, to a lot of patients, including myself, is how can I best participate in my own care? Another question that comes to mind is how important is it to establish a good physician-patient relationship? And most of us know what that's all about. And third, what is shared decision-making or guided collaboration process all about? So really, today's discussion is all about the doctor sharing with us their experience, but also with the questions that we have obtained and questions along the way, we'll try to get through some of the questions and get you some of the answers there. So let me introduce the two doctors to you. First of all, Dr. Gardner Nix has been on a courtesy staff at Northumberland Hills Hospital since 2014 and has focused much of her career on chronic pain management. She trained in the renowned Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness-based stress reduction and evolved his program to meet the needs of those suffering from chronic pain, developing the mindfulness-based chronic pain management program, which supports patients in learning skills for changing their relationship with pain, suffering, and stress, and developing new habits that involve neuroplastic changes of the brain, or in the brain rather. Dr. Gardner Nix is also an associate professor in the Department of Anesthesia at the U of T and has a special interest in hospice care, currently serving as a vice chair of Community Care Northumberland's board of directors. In her personal life, she lives in Port Hope with her husband and a new puppy, has three daughters and four grandchildren. Welcome aboard, Dr. Gardner Nix. Next, we have Dr. Al Ali. I don't know whether you folks can see him yet.
Yep.
Good. So Dr. Al Ali has been a surgeon on the surgical services team at Northumberland Hills Hospital since 2012. A fellowship-trained breast surgeon, surgical oncologist with oncoplastic training from the University of Toronto and the Breast Institute of Paris, or in Paris rather, France. Dr. Al Ali also has extensive training in colon cancer and melanoma surgeries. He is an assistant professor and a regular lecturer at Queen's University and was first drawn to medicine due to a fascination with anatomy, the endless pathologies, and the opportunity to make a huge difference in people's lives in a meaningful way. Dr. Al Ali, in his personal life, is a father of two and loves architecture, photography, and design. Welcome aboard, Dr. Al Ali. So I'll start off with both doctors giving us a bit of history, and we'll start with Dr. Jackie Gardner Nix and to tell us a bit about how they've seen the evolution in the last while they've been practicing. Go ahead, Dr. Nix.
Okay, thank you, Bill. So I'm going to start by going back 65 years to when I was a child. And we had a family doctor in England. We lived in a dormitory suburb of London, England at the time. And our family doctor lived up the road from where we lived. So it was just a short walk up one block. We didn't call them blocks there, past the semi-detached houses to his what we called surgery, which was his waiting room where you sat in the waiting room until the green light above the door of his consult room went green from red and you were able to walk in and tell him your problem. And he would pull out this little brown card from a brown envelope and on one line he would write the consult note, sore throat, aspirin and salt water gargles and tuck it back in again. His word was gospel. And it was very easy for him to come and do home visits because his patients just lived around him. It was also really easy for him to understand the biopsychosocial and spiritual aspects of all his patients because he lived amongst us. We were a fairly non-diverse culture at that time, and he had been into all his patients' homes. And the minute you walk in to a patient's home, you know a whole ton of information about them, about their psychosocial, that subliminally informs your decisions on how to treat. he would know how he probably couldn't get somebody's pain under control because they were in a difficult, challenging household. He would know so much about his patients that didn't need to be even asked, because he would gradually absorb it as he continued to follow us in a sort of a linear way, because we saw him maybe infrequently for some, but there were, he was building on his experience with us all. Well, fast forward to the time when I trained in medicine, about 20 years later, and I was aware that by being beside the patient's hospital bed or seeing them in an office and using the bio part of that biopsychosocial that I just said, the bio part, the evidence based in what we knew, and applying what we knew to provide the best suggestions for treatment, that I was losing a whole slew of information about that patient unless I took the time to ask them about their psychosocial situations. There was a vast amount that I didn't know. I mean, even in the days when I was a child, the specialists actually came to the house and saw us. In fact, it was palliative care that I went into for a few years in the 1990s that gave me back that information. And I remember walking to people's homes at that time to help with the dying process, and realizing that it was such a relief to pick up that psychosocial again and really understand the milieu that the patient lived in and what the family, the patient, and the caregivers needed from us that we could now provide, because we had a more holistic view of each of the patients that we saw in that setting. So I kind of felt hampered by not knowing about the psychosocial unless I asked those questions. We did pick them up when we were in family practice by sequentially seeing patients. We pick it up less when we don't look after many of the extended family members because we're too full and we can't fit them into our practices, so they have to go elsewhere. But I also think it was particularly lost as we super specialized. So the plethora of information and research forced the siloing of specialties to a large extent. Respirologists subspecialized in aspects of respirology. Neurologists subspecialized in such areas as Parkinson's disease and so on. So the specialties became more and more focused. But in that time that you have to wait longer to see the subspecialties, and in the consultation time that you have with them, there isn't very much time to actually go into the psychosocial aspects of your care. That doesn't matter if the biological is enough. So if they're bringing their evidence base and their research to us as patients sufficiently that actually the outcomes are great, then that works. And sometimes we need that. We need that technical aspect of what they know. And sometimes if we're in urgent situations, we need that paternalistic care rather than the holistic care to save our lives. But when we're dealing with chronic illnesses, and certainly when I was dealing with chronic pain in the pain clinics of the teaching hospitals, I needed to know the psychosocial milieu in which somebody was living. I needed to know the spiritual aspect of them, if that was a big focus for them as well. And indeed, the indigenous populations require, and they have a conversation about this at a high level, that their care is bio, psycho, social, spiritual, and collaborative with their own traditions in treatments. And I think actually they have the right idea about this. So there's a sense of some physicians choosing to be more technical and acknowledge that they really don't know enough, they haven't had enough mental health training, and they're not so invested in the social aspects of their patients. And then there are others, probably family physicians, pediatricians, and others who need to be take a more stance, more like a gardener than a technician, in order to tend the, I guess, softer aspects of care. We actually do need to know about our patients' exercising, eating, and sleeping habits and routines. They become an tremendously important part of the advice that we collaborate on in order to give advice that works. For example, I knew I could never get good pain management in somebody who was still living in an abusive household. It factored in to the outcomes that I would see. I knew that in the severe migraineur, a man that I saw who was having the kitchen sink thrown at him of treatments for migraines, that actually what really worked when he came into our mindfulness courses was the insight that he gained that he was in the wrong profession, that he was managing his father's company while his father was drawing a pension from it. And it just was a terrible fit for him, that he needed to have that difficult conversation with his father to move out of that work. And when he did so, his migraine frequencies and intensities declined. So in other words, we do need to know the psychosocial. We need to know if somebody's food insecure or shelter insecure. We also need to understand when we are working collaboratively with patients, we need to understand that we have subliminal biases that surface just from what's been installed through our lifetimes, and that we need to recognize them and mitigate them when we recognize them. There is so much evolution now from paternalistic care, like I described of the family doctor in my childhood, where my parents looked up to him and nobody questioned him. He was a lovely doctor. But we are evolving much more now into the sort of care where we need to collaborate and be part of the solutions and the conversation as patients. Now, there's a plethora of information that our doctors have to take in order to provide that expert advice that we need from them. But there's also, of course, a plethora under Dr. Google for us all. We all tend to consult Dr. Google, so we can also access information. And what's difficult for our doctors is if we go online and we start to go with unreliable sources. And there will be a PACE talk later on in the year on how to access the best information. But Ottawa Hospital and the Mayo Clinic have actually provided websites where you can go in and find your diagnosis and then be guided through the sorts of questions that you would like to ask so that you're well informed when you get into the doctor's office and can actually do collaborative care. So that's one of the things about how you can actually, yeah, there it is. Patient decision aids that has just come up. So this is a great website to help you to discuss on a more collaborative basis with your doctors, your diagnosis, and the options that you have. And the options you have, our doctors need to understand that the milieu in which we live, the context in which we live, needs to be taken into account in order to ensure we have the best outcomes. Something as simple as, are we moving house at the time that we've been scheduled for an elective surgery, where we have the choice to put off that surgery, because you're not gonna heal as well when you're going through life stressors. And so one may need to bring that to the table when thinking about taking certain treatments. So just checking into my notes here. We also don't tend to retain a lot of information that we are given in our consultations. One study I think showed less than 11% was retained when we walked out of the doctor's office. How can we manage that? And that's coming along as well. I guess one way, the older way and still a good way, is if we don't mind a family member or a partner, a significant other, coming into the consultation. And they can also provide collateral information that may help very much in your treatment. So then there's two heads walking out with that information. But more and more now, hospitals and clinics are providing the consultative notes to you so that you're able to actually read what happened in that consultation and refresh and gather in all the information that was provided. NHH is going in that direction with the EPIC program, which is going to allow patients to see their consult notes a few days after the consultation. And I think that's going to be very helpful. On the other side of the coin, the physicians are going to have to write more simply in order to be able to convey that information such that you would be able to understand. So we're going to have to drop some of our shorthand. We had one terrible shorthand we used to use for years, which was to say that the patient denied alcohol use. What we really meant was they didn't drink. But still, when patients read that kind of terminology, it tends to push them back a little bit and make them feel that they're not being respected. And so definitely things will change from the physician's perspective. One of the things that's been offered by our provincial Ministry of Health, which I think is very helpful, is that they've put out on a website, they put out a page which informs what qualities patients, caregivers, and families value in their interactions with their healthcare professionals. And these come under several categories, such as accountability, transparency. This slide will go up at the end of the talk, in fact. Respect and dignity, and equity, and an acknowledgement of inherent biases so that we can adjust. As physicians, as healthcare providers, we need to be familiar with that document and offer what the patient, families, and caregivers have asked for. And certainly my chronic pain sufferers have gone through a lot of consultations where they didn't feel respected, where they did feel their issues were minimized when they had very complex conditions. They needed more compassionate responses. They did not need to go to a specialist who said, I've done all the tests, they're normal, I can't help you anymore. It was what they were looking for was more compassion than that. I've done all the tests, it's not in my area of expertise, but I believe you, and I believe there will be a specialist out there that can help, and let me have a chat with your family doctor to find out where we can direct you next. The difficulty is that we have long wait lists too, which aren't particularly helpful, but we're hoping that by maybe working towards reducing wait lists, making sure we know your psychosocial aspects by asking the right questions, are you bringing some of those psychosocial aspects to the consultation that you think are relevant? By also learning what is relevant, there are educational programs, education for patients, cognitive behavioral programs, mindfulness programs that allow us to become more discerning in what we need for our care and how the mind-body are connected, so that we understand that too, and we can bring what is relevant to our doctors to the consultation. Those are all areas that we can improve on as patients while the doctors improve on becoming more collaborative and less paternalistic. I think that's as much as I need to say, Bill. So maybe we could pass over to Cass.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And it's been a while since the doctor has popped into my house to see me. But anyways, Dr. Al Ali, please, away you go.
Thanks, Bill. And thank you to everybody who worked hard on making this happen. Are you able to hear me, everyone?
Yes.
Great. And thanks for the wonderful intro and for all the insight, Dr. Gardner-Nix. That was fantastic. Now, from my angle, I come from a generation where I practiced medicine during wartime. And during that time, there was hardly an opportunity for a doctor-patient interaction to be the way it is now. You are dealing with incredibly limited resources, and time was the most precious item on the table. You had to make split decisions, and you had to manage complex cases with absolutely nothing at hand. And I remember one of my first shifts when I was a fresh grad, I was handed over a bag with two ampoules of antibiotic and four IV cannulas and five IV bags of fluid. And I was supposed to manage a pediatric ward, which had 100 beds. And that was kind of the situation in 1998. And I mean, trying to reason with every single patient on the floor where there are 100 beds when you have only two ampoules of antibiotics would be virtually impossible. So but medicine has come a long way. It doesn't mean that approach was right. We have to find what I usually call a collaborative guidance, that sweet spot where collaboration and guidance meet. You can't really, as a physician, be a paternalistic person with an asymmetrical relationship where you force yourself on the patient, you focus on outcomes, and you look at the disease, but you forget the human being. You can't be that physician, because you will miss, as Dr. Garanik said, you'll miss a lot. You'll miss a lot of what's happening. On the other hand, you can't be that Mary Poppins kind of person, and you listen to every single word, every single time, because that will lead to a tremendous delay. And not everything that the patient wants aligns with what medicine says. So we have to find that sweet spot where collaboration and guidance meet. And that's where you as a physician become most successful. I have the unique opportunity of dealing with people who fight cancer most of the time. And a lot of these patients come with their families, and they're, you know, terrified, they're concerned. Some of them have done all sorts of online searches. And that adds complexity to the conversation. You now have to bring in the knowledge, your expertise, which is evidence-based. You also have to look at the patient's angle, which brings in the patient's values, culture, and beliefs. And also you have to try to trim away the misconceptions or some of the information that's absolutely correct, but not in line with what you practice in your own location. So you deal with all this in one meeting, and it can be very difficult. So while I personally definitely believe that we need to work with our patients as a whole, not with the patient's illness only, that collaborative guidance is, I think, where I feel we need to focus on. I mean, I have attended a workshop in Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, which is one of the best cancer centers in the world. And it was basically about psycho-oncology. It basically dealt with how patients feel fighting cancer, how to not forget about the mind and not just focus on the body. And, you know, it was an eye-opener for somebody like myself who deals with cancer all the time. But definitely it made me think about this aspect that we tend to ignore. We are, as physicians, have been trained to save lives. We are more results-driven, outcome-driven. We don't really focus a lot, or probably not enough, on how the journey looks like. We focus on the destination. We want our patient to live. We want that cancer to be treated. We want that perforation to be sealed, that bleeding to be stopped, etc. But in the midst of all this, many times, because we're so perfectionists and we are so obsessed with outcomes, we forget the journey. We forget the passenger, himself or herself. What did they feel about this? And to this point, I recently had a patient that was an elderly patient. And for privacy, of course, I can't go into a lot of details, but that individual insisted on a certain treatment for a certain condition, because that individual felt that is
in. We lost you there, Dr. Al-Ali.
Pardon me?
We just lost you for 10 seconds there.
I'm sorry. Are you able to hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that individual was very much adamant about a particular approach to a particular problem, because it aligned with certain values and beliefs that individual carried. I tried my best to explain that there is a better approach, but I ended up having to respect the patient's choice. And unfortunately, the outcome was not the best. Now, from the medical aspect, did I believe that that was the right choice? Absolutely not. But that was the choice the patient felt. It met the values the patient carried. So that leads me to one thing that I see commonly, which is very much related. It's what I call the what would you do dilemma, the WWID dilemma. You sit in front of a patient and he tells you, so if it was you or if it was your father, what would you do? And we commonly get that question, and that person is basically asking me, not about the medical science, he's asking me, what would my values and beliefs lead me to choose in this particular situation? So if values and beliefs were so important to that patient that he wants to know, how am I going to approach this? How come that I don't dig into those values and beliefs myself? Because they are that much important that the patient actually wanted to know, what would I do? What would my father do? If this was my wife, what would I do? So WWYD dilemma is something we face in cancer in particular all the time. You get an elderly man or an elderly lady and the son is sitting there and he goes, so what would you do if this was your father? Would you go and do this 5-hour bowel resection and he's like 89? Or would you go for something more limited, knowing that that is not medically and oncologically sound operation? So the idea of collaborating with the patient is not just about doing more, it's or doing less. It's also about doing right. And the word right is very objective, is very subjective. We tend to define right and wrong based on objective criteria, evidence-based research, our training, our experience. The patient looks at it in a different way. The patient looks at what's right and wrong in a very subjective way. Now, am I going to be able to climb that stairs after that massive operation? Am I going to look the same in front of my kids? Am I going to be exactly the way I was? Does this align with my religious and cultural beliefs, my upbringing? This is one of those things that you see commonly in the ICUs with end-of-life decisions. You go in and being somebody who trained in the GTA, you get in close to so many different cultures that look at death and sustaining life on a ventilator in totally different ways. And you really absolutely have to dive into that difference before you even approach the science. It will be a fatal mistake to sit there throwing numbers and statistics in front of a patient who's not interested in listening to this. That patient is interested in things which are way beyond what science says. Science is only part of the conversation, but the rest is something about life and death, afterlife. Did I do everything I could to save my parents? Was I there for them? Were the kids, the bigger family, and so on and so forth? So not to take a lot of everybody's time, I feel that working with patients as a team has to be under the umbrella of collaborative guidance. You still are, as a physician, in charge. The patient is here looking for your opinion, your advice, but you should not ignore that that advice has to be, to a great extent, not only based on science, but based on the things which are way beyond science, which are related to the patient, him or herself.
Thank you, Dr. Al-Ali.
Can I just comment on something, Bill?
Yeah, go ahead.
Cass was describing the platinum rule. The platinum rule is to treat a patient how they wish to be treated, mm-hmm. not really how we would wish to be treated. Even though they're asking us, what would you do? We also have to acknowledge that they're very different. They may be coming from a different culture. All sorts of differences may occur, their lives compared to ours. And it's how they need to be treated that we need to tune into. And that's going to take some education for us to do that and time to ask the questions that give us a picture of the the context that they're in. That's it.
Great. Yeah, we'll just start off by some of the questions. So we've received some questions from the folks out there, but I had one. And I fortunately have a doctor where when I go in, I have to wait for an extra hour, and it's for a good reason. And most of her patients are elderly patients. And as she's explained to me, it takes time to talk to them and to really find out what's going on. So one of the questions that I've been asked, and one of the questions that was asked, was what do you do with a doctor that doesn't have the time, that limits you to 10 minutes or one problem and kind of shoves you out the door? What then?
I believe that we need to respect that we may have our 10 minutes, but that it's a good idea to make some bullet points on a paper that's no longer than a few, no bigger than half a page, the things that we would like addressed, and to go in and to get through those questions and to indicate that you have that little list to get through. It helps the doctor to be more concise. I think it's also important to know that one needs to add in the bits of psychosocial information so they have it right there at hand. 2 weeks ago, I just moved house is a good example of what would go well on the chart, because it does tend to exacerbate your clinical conditions when you go through those kinds of stressors. So adding those pieces to the chart, but in time with those 10 minutes followed by another 10 minutes a few weeks later and so on, the concept will build up and there will be more rapport that can establish if you can exchange information succinctly and cover the pieces that you need covered.
If I may add to this, nowadays there are, as you know, there are so many ways of communicating with your physician. I sometimes get emails or letters, like printed letters, from patients who had, all sorts of questions or issues. My own breast clinic sometimes gets messages from patients with specific questions. The bottom line is, if you want your message to reach your physician, you have the right that the physician listens to you. You're not there in the clinic to receive a lecture. The physician can only make a decision if he listens. And actually, God gave us two ears and one mouth for that purpose, so that we listen more than we talk. So if at the end of the day, you go to the clinic and all you say is I, and then the rest is you listening to the physician, I think it's time to look for somebody else. Because how on earth would your physician be able to help you if all he's doing is looking at numbers and reports and he's not listening to you? It was said when I was a student that patients are the best teachers and patient wards are the best theaters. So, and that is always true. Like, it cannot be more true now, even with technology nowadays. So I think as a patient, you have the right to, voice that you are here to be heard. You have things to say. But on the other hand, you also have to be prepared when you come. There are lots of resources online that help patients prepare for a visit to a specialist so that they have the right stuff. Like if you go to a genetic specialist, for example, you have to have all the information about your family history. This is not the time to start calling Aunt Marie and ask about Aunt Susie. When did she have colon cancer and how old was she? That information you have to bring it along. So it's a shared responsibility from both sides, to be honest with you.
And it's not that easy to find an alternative physician. We need to acknowledge that.
I agree.
I was just going to mention that because there is a question that I've always had is, if I want to get a second opinion in health-related issues, where do I go?
It used to be much easier than it is now because it's very long waiting lists now. I also hope that colleagues who are asked for a second opinion will not stigmatize the patient and not see that as disrespectful of the first person that they consulted. So we need to actually watch our own judgmentalism and come to each consult with beginner's mind. I'm afraid these are terms that we use in mindfulness work, but it opens up so much better the connection and the communication between the patient and ourselves. If a referring healthcare professional passes a patient onto somebody with a somewhat derogatory label, I've had great difficulty with this patient, that doesn't help the receiving physician. We should never pass on a patient with any label that is disrespectful. We should allow the other physician who's about to consult with them to draw their own conclusions and create their own communication pathway. Mm-hmm. So I do believe strongly in that too.
Yeah, want to just make a point. If anybody would like to ask a question, if you just raise your hand, we'd be glad to have you ask. In the meantime, I'll just go to another question if we don't have any.
Oh, and, Bill, I think Spears has a question.
Go ahead.
Sue Spears.
Sue, are you on mute? Go ahead.
I'm unmuted, yes. Dr. Gardner-Nix, you mentioned here that you're working to reduce wait times. How are you planning to do that?
Yeah, no, I'm not personally working to reduce wait times. I think that what I'm saying is that we need to reduce wait times because it's not good care to wait for months and months and months, especially if you're struggling with a chronic disease. I've seen a number of my acquaintances, my colleagues, who've waited far too long for complex disorders and then got to the physician that they've been referred to and found that they need to be referred on further. I believe that we've got to do something about that. Now, there is a program called the ECHO program that's been used in chronic pain. And we need probably more of the ECHO program. And I'll tell you what that is. It's where specialists, and in this case, it was chronic pain specialists, and there would be two, three, four of them together working through the screen like we're doing now with family physicians who were bringing their cases to those specialists to say, these are the cases, these are the facts. What would you advise us to do so that we can eliminate them having to see you or at least intervene while they're waiting to see you and we can get on with the work and do something for them? And that was actually invented in the States, the ECHO program, by a rheumatologist who found who had far too many patients referred and very long wait times and instituted the ECHO program and dramatically reduced wait times, and also was able to spread their expertise so that the family physicians could actually manage those complex patients. I like the ECHO programs. I think there should be more ECHO programs.
Okay. Dr. Allen. I mean, personally, I have been waiting. I'm going to wait a year to 18 months to see a specialist when I was told it would be 6 months. And it's, you know, it's, I know it's everything's blamed on COVID, but it's very difficult to wait that length of time.
Absolutely.
Dead by the end of 18 months.
Yes. I mean, I really feel that some of the people I know with very chronic disease who are waiting and waiting for answers, their quality of life is the pits during that time, and it's just not fair. I would also always encourage my colleagues, people I know in this situation, to call the offices of the specialists and say you'll take any cancellation and call every couple of weeks to say that. The squeaky wheel sometimes does work.
Okay. Thank you very much. That helps.
Dr. Al-Ali, would you like to add to that?
Well, I mean, in terms of the, not to go too much into policy, but in terms of wait times and things like that, sometimes, you know, speaking with your family physician to look for alternatives, like some of our patients, for example, who are sent to tertiary centers who have long wait times, were actually seen sooner when they were referred to another center, like, for example, Kingston, because it has less load compared to Toronto centers. And so trying to triage where you end up going to by speaking with your family physician can sometimes help, number one. And number two, sometimes you actually don't know that your community has a specialist that can do exactly the same. So speaking with your GP about that can help. So our internal medicine program, for example, here in Coburg is growing and they're adding subspecialties to it. We're doing more surgeries and a wider range of operations than what used to happen in this hospital a decade ago. So you sometimes never know that actually specialist, they might even come to our town once a month and run a satellite clinic. So, I mean, keeping in touch with your GP sometimes helps, but I understand that that's not, you know, like the magic pill, but it can be sometimes that helps as well.
Okay, Okay, thank you.
I believe there were more than 40 specialists, 40 physicians added to NHH's roster of physicians attached to the hospital in the last year. It was a lot. I know Mukesh has the figures, but I also want to just acknowledge that the focus that's been placed on making our hospital, NHH, as rich as possible in their equipments and procedures, etc., has attracted people to Coburg to request the collaborative connection to the hospital, to the privileges at the hospital. So we are, as you say, Cass, growing to the extent that they may not have to go outside our communities as much anymore and can get quicker service here.
And you know, one last thing towards this point is that now with virtual care, you actually have access to an endless pool of specialists. There are all sorts of online programs that your family physician can use to send your referral electronically and connect you virtually with a specialist who doesn't have to travel to you. Now, that doesn't solve issues where a direct patient-physician interaction is needed, like a clinical examination and things like that. But it takes away those occasions where it's just a matter of a conversation and a remote visual you know, assessment of you and your case. And that actually allows, like we are running virtual clinics without really a timeline because, you know, I, for example, have a virtual clinic where I look at my electronic referrals that come from far and beyond, like from Barrie all the way to Sudbury. And I look at those every Thursday, Friday at night when I'm done and my wife is putting my son to bed. And I go through those and send them the information they need. So technology can allow you to actually, can allow you more access than before. And that can help sometimes when a direct like physical interaction is not really needed or not really very much essential.
Yeah, I think also that the consultations that are done through the screens are much more powerful than the consultations done by the phone. Sure. I like to see people and I feel I can get a lot through seeing people, even through screens. And ever since the pandemic hit, the mindfulness-based chronic pain management courses that we were running have gone virtual. And they actually work really, really well with about 15 patients and the facilitator, who's often an MD. And there's a lot can be done through learning about your own mind-body connection that can really lift the weight off the need to go for multiple consultations. So we are definitely offering a lot through the internet. I see this question in the chat though, saying, is the Ministry of Health discouraging virtual consultations now? And I think that they realize, having instituted the ability to do consultations through phone and through screens, that they can't take that away. It's just we've gone a long way very quickly with using these methods, but they have been, as Cass says, very useful and extended our reach and reduced commutes and all sorts of issues. And it's quicker for us to do those consultations that way.
Yeah, just a quick question there, further to what you just indicated. Usually when we travel, we're asked, have we had an annual visit and a full medical? And I find it a little difficult when you do it virtually. I'm being facetious here, but somewhere along the way, I kind of miss being knocked on the knee and kind of have the stethoscope on my back. I know technology is moving there, but still, you know, what are your comments on some of this new virtual versus in person?
Well, I mean, if I may, number one, there has been extensive research on that supported the lack of benefit from the annual visit. So that annual visit that our GPs were very much fond of, there has been lots of literature that showed it's actually not really necessary. And a lot of the tests that are done did not add any value to your health. In fact, they picked up a lot of false negatives and led to lots of resources wasted on tests that didn't really add much. So that's number one. Number two, the Ministry of Health, when they said that they want to modify their rules and support for virtual health, that was in the context of the priority is still to provide care in person. However, if you feel as a physician, you're able to provide equal quality of care without compromising on findings and decision-making by doing this virtually, then go ahead. But the priority is still for in-person care, because a lot of my fellow patients and physicians started to notice that there was a drop in the quality of care, because everybody is picking up the phone and not even doing like a video teleconferencing, because not every patient or every physician is facile enough to do that and use that technology. And when I first joined NHH, I ran a quick survey of my own patients on how many of them actually had access to a high-speed internet. And the numbers were representative of the fact that our area, our catchment area, covers a lot of countryside. And our patients who live in the countryside, north of a 401, many of them still suffer from lack of high-speed internet, and this is improving, obviously. So I can't ask that person who doesn't even have rapid, like high-speed internet, to be on the phone doing a video teleconference with his family physician. The generational change in this is happening. More and more, we're seeing our elderly patients very facile with internet. They book their own appointments. They do all the stuff online. They're comfortable with that. But so that in itself is a great move forward. There are companies now that will actually mail you a box which has a remote Bluetooth activated stethoscope, thermometer, all sorts of things, tongue depressor, everything. So you actually sit in front of the computer, you follow the instructions. When you finish, you drop those tools in the box and you mail them back. And the tests will be remotely sent to your GP's clinic through a secure link. That technology is beautiful when it works, but it's certainly not accessible. So for equity purposes, you can't really use it only for those who can afford it or those who have the ability to, but what about everybody else? So the ministry is still pushing to get physicians to see patients in person. The human interaction that we missed during COVID can sometimes, just looking at the patient, reading the facial expression can sometimes in itself, shaking their hands, feeling that cold hand as opposed to the warmth that you were used to. All these cues can help you sometimes in ways that numbers and blood tests don't.
Yeah, I agree.
Sorry, did you want to add anything?
I think actually virtual care is allowing us to be more time efficient. Yes. But I also agree, Bill, that it's nice to be touched by your physician and to have that connection. And that is also how the physician is going to learn much more about the psychosocial you when they're, it's fine to know that the physical exams haven't got as much evidence base to them, it's true. But I think it might be easier to manage some of the interaction about the stressors in your life, which underlie pretty much every clinical condition's exacerbation, when you're actually in person with your physician.
Okay. So with that, we'd like to end the session, but I'll just summarize some of what I saw and we'll have one more slide. So one thing that I did learn today is kind of Dr. Gardner next put me back about 50 plus years ago when the doctor did come to the house and did visit and did see what was going on. And sometimes even got a glass of beer or glass of wine. So that's one thing that I learned. The psychosocial that you brought up was really interesting. It's all about the people. What I also liked was what would you do dilemma, the WWYDD, and basically the collaborative guidance that you shared with us, Dr. Al-Ali. So a lot of great, great material. And I really thank you very much for sharing your experiences with us and also answering the questions that we had. The last slide that we had here was one that Dr. Gardner-Nix referred to. And the bunch of folks, actually the patient family caregiver group,
got together with the Ministry of Health and they put together the Declaration of Values for Ontario. There's more to it than you see here. So you've got accountability, empathy and passion, equity and engagement, and respect and dignity, and transparency. One thing that you may want to go to and take a look at what they call the expectations. And I'll just draw one out here. One under the respect and dignity. And one of the points was that we expect that we will be recognized as part of the care team to be fully informed about our condition and have the right to make choices in our care. And there are a couple of other points there that really fall in line with the discussion we had today, which is all about participating and patients getting together with their doctor and getting the decisions that they need. So with that, Dr. Bhargava, I'll pass it back to you. And thank you very much to both Dr. Gardner-Nix and Dr. Al-Ali for taking the time today and sharing the experiences and stories. Really appreciate it. And for the questions that people actually send to us.
Oh, you're on mute, Mukesh.
Story of our life. Still on mute.
You're back on mute.
Okay. This time I'm not muted. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Case. Thank you, Jackie. And thank you to the audience. You know, I would say that when we were planning this session, it came up like, why are we doing this? And what would we learn? And where is this conversation starting from? I would say that, you know, as people, all of us, even the doctors in the room have been patients. I've been a patient, and I'm sure the doctors who spoke have been patients. I would say there are three questions you should think of when you approach your healthcare and your healthcare provider. And it could be the healthcare provider is not just the doctor. It is the nurse, it is the occupational therapist, the physiotherapist, the nutritionist. All of them are important. They're part of your team. So what I would say is think through your mind, what is important to you? Is survival your thing? Is the health span, the lifespan? Is it freedom from encumbrances as you go through treatment important to you? Whatever it is, that is the first question you should think of, especially when you deal with a chronic disease. The other I would say is also think of what is bothering you the most. It may be a physical ailment, it may be a mental worry. It might be something else. It is, like Sue, as you pointed out, it is your inability to get a consult. You don't even know the suspense. What is the diagnosis? What do I have? That might be the biggest worry and sharing that. And is there something you're fearful about at the back of your mind? So those three things, and we as physicians need to do a better job in bringing those forward when we have a conversation with people. The second thing I'll start doing at these PACE talks is also bringing about books that people may want to read further if they have an interest. There are two books related to this topic that may be of interest to people. One, and they're both written by the same author, and I think there's a natural evolution. The first book is How Doctors Think. And it is not just about how doctors think. I think it should be How Do Healthcare Providers Think. It is written by Jerome Groopman. And then the second book he wrote was with his wife, which is Your Medical Mind. How we think as patients, how do we change our mind in different conditions at the onset when we are given a diagnosis or during the middle of the diagnosis or end of life, how things change. So if you are a book reader, those are the two books that relate somewhat to this topic. In closing, what I would also want to share with you what NHH has done and what our community has brought forward to address specifically a couple of these related items. One, as who you said about wait times. We are acutely aware and we see at NHH beyond the walls of the hospital that this is our domain. If you come into the hospital, that is what we should treat you, get you in and out safely, quality, et cetera. We also look, and I think Susan is in the audience, our CEO, and our collective goal at Senior Team is how do we bring not just care closer to home, but we also take, if we can't take care of you, get you taken care of. And one example we'll give you is something called a hosted OTN model, because in the comment section there was this, what if I don't have internet, I don't have good internet. Case pointed out as a physician, you know, the virtual consult is better, but not everybody has the resources. We are partnering with providers to bridge that gap. You could come to NHH, your provider may be in Toronto, we have a nurse, a crackerjack nurse who will help with the physical exam. We have the electronic stethoscope that Case is talking about that can be put on, and a very sophisticated camera that can zoom into lesions, and that is transmitted over the internet. What did we resolve with this? You might say, oh, this is all technology. Last year, and Jackie mentioned, we recruited 30 people. Two of them are neurologists. Our neurology wait time was greater than 1 year. It has come down to less than 1 month. So that is how we are bridging the gap, and we need all of us to help with this. You should be open to the idea that, yeah, I can go to the hospital and get help with a nurse, with a camera, and those kind of things. So that is what we are doing. And Susan, if you want to add more to that, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I know you're here. And Susan, do you want to say something?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Mikesh, and thank you for sharing that example. We're about to launch our strategic planning process. And one of the things that we really want to emphasize is, how do we bring care closer to home? How do we ensure that care is integrated across the system? Hospital is one moment in time that somebody is in contact with us. So how do we ensure that we're a partner across the continuum? And that would include our partners such as the Ontario Health Team of Northumberland. So we're very excited about this, and this will be a major focus of our strategic plan as we start to build that out. I anticipate. We haven't finished yet, so.
Okay.
Great talk. Thank you, everyone.
So before I end our session, I want to share with you who is behind these sessions. So there is a group of people who will prepare a recording. These are students from Loyalist College. These are folks who are students in the School of Media and Film, and they will prepare this recording in a fashion better than just a simple Zoom recording, and that is our first for this year. So I don't see them on the screen, but if you can come on screen and wave, that would be great. The other is the NHH Foundation, and Jen Gilmore is there, and Jen, you can wave. So these are the supporters that I'm naming. And again, it's not a sponsorship. It is not something that they get out of it. The other major one is NHH, and obviously Jennifer Gillard, who you know, and that is she. Jennifer, you can wave. That is, Jen is the brains behind how we communicate, how we keep it, that this is not a spam, this is not something we flood your emails with. She keeps us on track, and she introduces us to people. So that is Jen Gilmer. Then we have the Family Health Team, the Northumberland Family Health Team. I don't think Adrian is here, but we have their support. And we also have the Community Health Centers in Port Hope. And obviously, my practice, this is where it started 5 years ago, and Jennifer was giving me credit for it. I said, pace has changed so much that what it started is no longer what it is. So this is what the community has made it. Those are the people behind it and that make it happen. So I appreciate your contribution and thank you for that. And again, Case and Jackie, you have started a conversation and you could see by things, and let's get this to a shared decision making. And Jackie, to your point, when you were describing that visit, I recall the days that I did these home visits with my father. I would be his assistant, carry his doctor's bag and the machine. And a little bit of the virtual visits reminded me of that, because when you did a virtual visit today, you can see what is in the background. Is there a sport paraphernalia? Is this certificates, like, you know, Art, I see you have a back wall of certificates behind you, or appreciation or awards. So you do make connections like that when you are doing these, but they are too far and few in between. So thank you for spending your evening with us. Stay tuned. I have the next three topics. We'll pick one from either sleep, getting back on the track of preventive care, aging gracefully. We need your support in finding, if you have heard a great speaker, or you think it would be a great speaker, please email me or Jennifer Gillard at the hospital, and we will try to source them down. I have never had anybody turn us down to be a PACE speaker. So I think aim high. If you think of somebody, just tell us and we'll reach out to them for you. Thank you and good night. And thank you to the speakers. And thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good night, folks. Bye.